Welcome to Pod Space Nine, the last stop for trash in the Alpha Quadrant. This is a rewatch podcast for Star Trek Deep Space Nine, featuring two veteran viewers and one newbie. My name is Justin, and I'll be your way team commander. Joining me is my science officer, Anna, with our acting ensign, Jude. But not only do we have our usual crew today, we have the returning conquering hero, Velvet. Velvet, welcome back to the show.
Hi, glad to be back. I'm here again, and it probably won't be the last time I'm inflicted on all of you.
I feel like with like Evan becoming our like Irish Irish suffering correspondent, you have become our Trill and Gender correspondent.
Yeah, I'll accept that.
Nice.
Excellent. Yeah. Velvet, for those of you for those of our listeners who maybe haven't listening to these out of order, I don't know why you would. I would consider that to be a weird experiment. For people who might have unfortunately forgotten who you are, care to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Velvet. I'm an artist and actual play podcaster, and I guess other general purpose podcaster now. I can be found in the City That Never Dies, Blades in the Dark actual play on the Clever Corvids Network and on Twitter at Velvet Dragon. Art will be up there again soon. Twitter isn't shitting, so I don't know what to do with it anymore. But
my favorite like thing recently is seeing all of the sites having to modify all of their links of like on wiki pages, like this person's profile on X brackets formerly Twitter.
Yeah.
and all of the and how like Twitter embed things everywhere are completely broken still.
Yeah.
Of perpetually. Mm-hmm. Forever.
Talking about things that are not broken perpetually forever, this is our first recording past the holiday season, or at least the new year of 2024. This is our first 2024 recording. Jude, Anna, how you doing?
Mildly refreshed.
Yeah, I had a good couple of weeks off. I could do with another 2 to 5, but you know, unfortunately we live in a capitalist hellscape.
Yep. Accurate.
Incredibly valid. Yeah.
How about you?
Oh, me? I did well. I took the week between Christmas and New Year's off. I got both ends of my family and I saw some family members that I like haven't seen in like half a decade, which was cool. It's like it's a very nice feeling to like see family members of yours who like the last time you saw them they were small children and now they're like in college and they're cool,
which yeah, is yeah,
I don't know, it's like
I find that it's existentially terrifying, but yeah, you
mean,
do you
it's yeah, I mean like the fact of it is that like my like one of my like I got to see one of my cousins who like lives in Texas and was like she was visiting for the holidays and was like cool, and I was like, oh, you're in college now? Wait, I can have an adult discussion with you? Cool.
Yeah, I had a bit of the same thing over Thanksgiving, seeing my nieces and nephew for the first time in a hot minute. And like last time I saw them they were all in the kind of late teens, but now they're all like have graduated and have jobs and they're all rad partners, and it's like, hey, it's like genuinely really fun to talk to all of these people. It was lovely.
Yeah.
One of my nieces that I babysat for when she was a toddler was recently, my mom forwarded me a picture of her on stage at some big like tech convention talking about venture capitalism and AI. And I was just like, I'm so old. Like, not like that. Justin made the oh god AI face. It was a general like discussion about the changes in the venture capitalism. Blah blah blah.
I wasn't really paying attention. Those are four words that like set off my flight or fight.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. But it was just wild to see her in a context that like I grew up seeing her dad in, because her dad was a venture capitalist back in tech in the 90s and 2000s. And so it was wild to see her doing this. I'm just not used to her not being a kid. And there is no parsing her being a kid. There is no way for that to be true. And I'm not okay with it.
I spent the holidays inside avoiding my family. but it was pretty nice.
I mean, that's an entirely valid way to go as long as you had a good holiday. Nice.
So tonight, we have, I think, two very fun episodes.
I agree. This was a wonderful pair of episodes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Last time I was on here, it was pretty one-sided, but I enjoyed both of these.
Yeah, I think, like, if I forcing me to rank things is, I think, a crime. I think it is, in fact, a war crime. But, like, if I gun to my head, I would put both of these episodes in my top 30 and our second one in the top 10 episodes of DS9, period.
Yeah.
Which is high praise.
Yeah.
Certainly, I enjoyed them quite a bit. I need to see a lot more DS9 to rank them, but of the episodes I've seen, they would certainly be in the top something.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I have the first of them.
Yeah, tonight we are covering episodes 18 and 19 of Season 2, Profit and Loss and Blood Oath. Jude, take us away.
I've got Profit and Loss. It is episode 18 of season 2, written by Flip Kobler and Cindy Marcus. Flip Kobler's a great name. I don't know what context I feel like that name should be in, but it's great. And directed by Robert Weimer. The episode opens on a distressed Cardassian vessel approaching the station. It's tractored in, and at the lock, Sisko and O'Brien meet its occupants, Professor Natima Lang and her two students, Raquelin and Hogue. Sidebar, Natima Lang is the least Cardassian name I've ever heard.
I think it's just the Lang particularly is just like, Lang is just one of those names that like...
It just sounds hella mundane.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's one of those things that it's like, I know like three Langs.
Yeah. Also most Is Natima Lang the first Cardassian we've met who, like, has two names?
Yeah, unless you count Gull.
Yeah, because Gull is a title, though.
Yeah, maybe?
Yeah.
At least, like, stated.
Yeah, it's, like, it's either the Cardassians who appeared in, like, that first episode of TNG.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, but I can't think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think any of the like.
You mean Proto Gul Dukat?
Yeah, Proto Gul Dukat, who is like, by the way, like
Proto Gul Dukat.
We should watch The Wounded one day just because it's a good episode.
Yeah,
that's like
yeah.
It's like a Proto O'Brien episode.
It really is. Like, I just watched that the other day, and I was like, I was thinking that we need to cover it. As an honorary O'Brien must suffer.
Yeah.
It's not even a suffer episode. It's like, O'Brien has PTSD. That's what it is. But
yeah.
Anyway, in an entirely un-Cardassian way, or maybe it's because she's a woman and it's just Cardassian men or all men who suck. She is both aware of and sensitive to the discomfort that her and the other Cardassians' presence on the station will cause. Sisko advises her to just stay on the promenade and she should be fine, which ends up being dubious advice, as she is soon spotted by Quark, who is currently flirting with Odo over a cloaking device Odo thinks he has, who Leroy Jenkinses himself out of the bar when he spots her to be welcomed with an unhesitating bitch slap, which discourages him absolutely not at all, as he declares to Odo that this is the happiest day of his life. He follows them.
I think you should teach that. They should teach that. Like, they should show that slap to acting students.
It's an incredible slap. It's real satisfying. And if it did not, in fact, connect, that woman is a terrific actress. Quark follows them through the promenade, eventually corralling them back into his bar, flirting outrageously with Natima the whole time. It transpires that she at one time lived on the station before Odo was there and worked as part of the Cardassian Information Service, but now teaches political theory and is going to change Cardassia, according to Raquelin. Odo, jealous that his boyfriend is paying attention to someone else, tries to get Quark's attention by insulting him, but Quark is just utterly focused on the team up. He's just starting to thaw the ice a bit when she spots Garak, who also has been doing a lot of flirting, in this case with Bashir, at the bar. And this immediately causes distress in Natima and her students, who flee. They head to Ops, where they admit, mere moments after O'Brien tells Sisko, that the damage to their ship was not from a meteor storm, as they had first claimed, but from being shot at by Cardassians. They admit to being part of an anti-military political movement who are currently wildly and now violently unpopular with the ruling government. But Natima believes that the future of Cardassia depends on their survival. We'll talk in the notes about the extremely, like, hyperbolic way that these people talk about their importance. It's a thing. Hyperbole aside, I will grant that Cardassia seems shitty, and it's probably in their best interest to invest in alternate forms of government. Quark, meanwhile, has put two and two together and heads to Garak's to see what he can do. They have a discussion about fashion, and Garak very cleverly and eloquently communicates the danger that Natima is in by associating with her politically radical students. Quark buys a dress from Garak, though it's unclear what he's paying for. Advice, perhaps? As we will find out, it's certainly not his silence. Then heads to see Natima, where we get some backstory in his offer to try and help. She declined to turn him over to the authorities for selling food to Bajorans, and they had a month-long love affair that ended when Quark used her access codes to steal from the Cardassian government. Who could blame him? He says he doesn't...
Honestly, most heroic thing Quark's done.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he says he does not regret the stealing, but he does regret breaking her trust. Can't argue, Quark. Yeah. Can't argue with you there.
It is always morally correct to steal from fascists, but doing it, like, by betraying your girlfriend's trust by doing that, no, don't do that.
Yeah. he says that she has to stay, because otherwise he's going to follow her, even if it means giving up everything, the bar, his whole life for her. She makes him leave by saying she doesn't love him. Garak stops by Ops to inform Sisko that the Cardassian warship that has suddenly appeared, phasers hot and phone off the hook, wants Natima and her students, but it's a really trivial matter. So trivial that that's why they've made him communicate it with Sisko. Sisko, in absolutely no mood for bullshit, tells him to fuck off promptly. In the bar, Quark manages to corner Natima's two students and offers them the cloaking device that he swore to his soggy top that he did not have, and doesn't even take them up on their offer to pay for it. He does, however, set his price as Natima is staying behind. The faces that Velvet and Justin made when I said soggy top was...
Yeah, how dare you drop that on us in the middle of the description?
Fucking hate you.
For her own safety, of course, is the price of her staying. When she confronts him over this, he refuses to accept that she doesn't want to stay with him, ultimately forcing her to stun him. She immediately regrets doing so, even though it wasn't enough of a stun to do more than knock him down, and admits she does love him, and they start to make out. Despite her admission, however, she is still adamant that the movement is her life now. Quark simply cannot give it up, and she eventually relents just in time for Odo to play ear blocker and bust in and arrest her, per Sisko's order. It turns out that the Cardassians have bribed the Bajoran Provisional Government with half a dozen Bajoran prisoners. This, it ends up, however, is a ruse, as Garak is then ordered to assassinate all three by former rival frenemy Gul Turan. Not clear what their relationship is, except that Turan hates him.
Exes.
Yeah, I mean, I assume everybody wants to fuck Gul, to fuck Garak, so I buy it.
Yeah.
Quark, meanwhile, confronts Odo, and they have a short lover spat in which Quark literally begs on his knees. He asks Odo to do it for him. Odo says he'll do it for justice and lets them all go with Quark. Unfortunately, Garak, weary of exile, catches them at the ship lock. Before he can finish the job, however, the aforementioned Gul Turan, who gave him the orders, pops out from behind a crate like a goddamn jack-in-the-box, having followed Garak to make sure he did the job. Garrick, confronted with the reality that Taran will never let him get anything out of this, vaporizes him and lets the others escape. Quark gets one more kiss from Natima, then she leaves with her students. Quark and Garrick leave for the promenade, and that's it. That's the end. No discussion of consequences or fallout. This prisoner exchange doesn't happen. Guns firing. Garrick literally vaporizes a military officer from an opposing regime on the station, and nobody ever talks about it again, I guess. Whatever.
It's fine. It's fine.
Listen, people rightly bemoan the loss of more episodic TV, but there's a way to go too far with it, and sometimes you get shit like this.
Yeah, I've noticed this with DS9, but Bab 5 did it too, where sometimes an episode ends and you're just like, what the fuck? Like, where are the, like, you needed two more minutes just to, like, there's like, so many there guns in this
scene of, there needed to be like 90 sec, like there needed to be like 2.5 minutes more of episode that had like Sisko like talking about a log and like Sisko saying to Garrick, like, well, Taran wasn't supposed to be on the station or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and like, but don't let it happen again.
And something like being like vaguely menacing with the baseball too. Right. Yeah,
just some kind of acknowledgement that everything about that situation was fucked up.
Yeah.
I also have to ask, does DS9 just have no weapon scanners? Those weapon scanners in that one episode with the Bajoran rebels, did they just never come back online? Because Natima's got a gun, Garrick's got a gun, Gul Turan somehow sneaks on board.
So
from a warship,
I know the answer.
Their shields are up. What is going on?
I think I may know the answer to this. Weapons are not allowed on the promenade.
Yes, that's where all the, like, they're basically on every, like, entrance to the promenade, there's weapon scanners to, like...
Oh, fine. So you can vaporize people in cargo holds and private residences,
but you just can't vaporize people at the mall, which I can respect. I can respect that Star Trek says that you can't bring a gun to the mall.
I mean, as an American, I am entirely on board with that.
If you want to shoot someone, you do that in the privacy of your own quarters. Castle Doctrine.
It's a personal choice.
This is for legal purposes, a joke.
Yeah.
We're just in a random corridor somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you can kill some, like, I have to imagine that, like, in like a slightly parallel universe DS9, there is just like gang warfare in the corridors.
Yeah. Okay. So I have some thoughts about this. One fun note about this episode I want to get out of the way. Miles the fuck O'Brien. Why in Christ's name would you give our resident wet fascist I the Jury by Mickey Spillane, a book that introduces a character principally noteworthy for his extreme violent handling of his private detective affairs. This is a guy in the Wikipedia article, it is noted, routinely punches people in the balls and in the stomach so hard they vomit. He is unrelenting in his, I'm not joking, you Google it and you'll see. This is a guy who is open about being a misanthrope and using violence on violent people. What in the actual Christ were you thinking, O'Brien?
By joke, yes, listen, he does that because Dashiell Hammett wasn't Irish.
That's fucking funny. I get it. I know that in the future we are going to have holodeck episodes where Odo is a detective. Somehow that information is in my brain from like random episodes of DS9 watching on basic cable when I was a kid. Like, I kind of have this vague recollection of...
No.
That's not a thing?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, I thought that's what this was like a setup for, but...
I know what episodes you're thinking of, though.
Well, I have this vague recollection of like Odo and like noir detectives being associated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, fine. Whatever. So I got the sense that they were like maybe planting a seed for that here, but also maybe they're just idiots suggesting that someone would be dumb enough to give Odo a book encouraging detectives to brutalize people.
I suspect it's basically like, you know, hey, here's something that like the viewers will recognize as being a noir detective novel because it is a famous one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's the I was.
But yeah,
when I Googled it and I read like the first two lines of description about what this book was about, I just was flabbergasted.
Although, I have a different favorite thing with that plot, though, or with that prop, which is that the pad that they use for that book, they reuse the pad that they used in If Wishes Were Horses when O'Brien was reading Rumpelstiltskin to Molly. Mm-hmm. And so it still has the Rumpelstiltskin illustrations on it.
Oh, interesting.
So Odo is reading, I mean... Did O'Brien just hand him Rumpelstiltskin and tell him it was noir?
That's funny.
Listen, theoretically, these can hold more than one book.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
I mean, you see people walking around with like a stack of pads being like, I've got all of my reading for the vacation. And I'm like, what is wrong with you?
Well.
You don't need a stack of Kindles, my dude.
Nobody knew that, like, real-life people were going to take pads, make them real, and make them better than the ones on Star Trek.
Yeah. What year was this episode?
1994?
All right, that's valid. Stepping into the more body of the episode, my first thought is that this is a surprisingly horny episode.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Everybody... that appears on screen, except for Sisko, basically, and the two students, and I can fan fiction that in my head if I really want to, is like emotionally like compromised by somebody else in the plot. You have this weird triangle between Odo and Quark and Natima. You have Garrick and Bashir. You've got the weird energy between Garrick and Gul Turan.
Yeah.
I absolutely love Bashir and Garrick's like opening introduction.
It's so good.
It's the like first they start off with what will become my favorite method of flirting at this show. Talking politics and philosophy.
Yeah.
I think this is like the first time that it's like codified into words that like to a Cardassian, the highest honor is the is service to the state.
Yeah, Julian's prostate.
Like, Jesus Christ! Can't wait for Aaron to.
Justin's eyes were so good. There, Justin's eyes were just like, bah!
I'm so amazing. Glad I could just like serve that, a fastball like right down the middle.
Like as soon as he said that line at the end of the story, like I'd choose the state every time. I was like, that's all I could think. That was in my brain hanging over the rest of the episode.
And then it bookends with Garrick letting them go because he says, I love Cardassia.
Yeah.
Which this is, I think, one of my favorite traits of Garrick is that he is a Cardassian who believes truly what Cardassia and Cardassian values are, is that like service to the state and like not being an exceptional service to the state, but doing what is required of you is in fact the highest moral achievement that you can do as a Cardassian. But at the same time saying, shit's fucked. Mm-hmm. And, you know, hopefully like these people can build a better Cardassia.
It's like he starts to realize like what it actually means to be a patriot. in yeah. some ways, right?
He's one of the few Cardassians we've met so far that is able to separate the current government and the state and Cardassia as what it could be.
Yeah.
And this episode is the first time we see some other ones.
I mean, kind of, though, right? But, like, what he feels Cardassia could be is still very...
still very Cardassian.
It's ultimately not that different from how it is now.
Well, we don't know. We don't really know what he sees it as. We just know that he is not in favor of the current regime.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And also, at this point, he doesn't see himself as a super moral person by any metric either.
He's willing to
go against his own morals and other people's morals in equal measure, it seems like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's pretty amoral in that regard.
It's also pragmatic, right? Like, he lets them go. Partly, there is no benefit to him if he doesn't, right? Like, he's not going to get a reward. He's just going to get, like, the shit kicked out of him by Sisko and get kicked off the station, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there is no benefit to him if he assassinates them at this point. He's not going to get to go back to Cardassia. So, like, he might as well let them go and make it sound good.
Yeah. Sisko, speaking of, has a bananas line in this episode. Being shot at by your own people goes a little beyond politics, which is the most Federation naive horseshit line I've heard in a Star Trek episode in a hot minute. Because, I mean, shooting at your own people over politics is kind of what politics has been for a long time. That's kind of, I mean,
yeah,
it's such a wild
1994
line.
1994, though, right?
Yeah. Like, 1994, and, you know,
I knew the minute I mentioned it, you were going to get on your hobby horse about the political idealism of the 90s.
This is pre-impeachment Clinton era. We're like,
yeah,
like,
this was like Bill Clinton with the sax on Animaniacs era.
Yeah.
But I do think that this is interesting of like, this is the, we get a little bit of information about Cardassia here, specifically that it is a military government.
Yeah.
We get a little bit more clarification as we go along, but the fact that it is like, the Cardassian Union is a junta, and like that is, like yeah. the military is in charge, and there is a civilian government, but it is nominal and like mostly for show. But I find that interesting. Of just like, this is the first time we really get to it. We will get more of that as not the season, or like we'll get a little bit more of this as the season goes along. And definitely dive into it in later seasons.
Yeah. And it seems like everybody knows that too.
Yeah.
Quark makes his snarky remark at the end of the episode. All I have to do is wait for Cardassia to be a free and democratic society.
Oof, buddy. You never seen her again.
Yeah. I hope she comes back. But I would bet good money she never does. She feels like the kind of character that's a one and done.
Yeah. I don't think she comes back. I think she does not.
No. This is dropped forever. Unfortunately, because I feel like it's such a promising subplot, right? Like
the plot returns, but this character does not.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess the plot does return. Yeah.
And in fact, this plot is in fact the reason why everything goes bad.
Yeah.
This is a ticking time bomb that will come back later.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mostly I'm just wondering what she saw in Quark. What was young Quark like? Like, Quark has redeeming qualities, but like, how did this torrid like romance to span the ages happen? How did that start?
I
thought it was obvious. I mean, she clearly wanted someone to step on, and Quark is a groveling little bottom. I mean, like, I thought the dynamic there was very clear. I mean, don't get me wrong. I get that a Cardassian and a Ferengi is a weird pairing, but like,
there are jokes that I could make that would get me booted off this podcast.
I mean, sure, but like, this seems to run a little deeper than that, to the point where she was like trying to deny it the whole time, and then it's played as a joke when she is passionate.
Yeah, they seem to have like had. There seems to be genuine love there on both sides.
Yeah,
can I just say,
like, genuine passion?
The scene where they're talking about their trip to the holosuite. And
yes, yes. The answer is yes.
She talks about her face being covered in honey.
Yes.
I sat there with my straight face.
I'm sorry.
Jaw hanging open. I was like, who wrote this?
It is. I mean,
this episode. I know that not everybody watches DS9 as with through the horny lens that we do. But holy shit, guys. My God. So
that's what the Ferengi and/or Cardassians call it.
I think that is one of those things where you see two people and you're like, it doesn't make sense. But they just have, like, insane chemistry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I loved this episode. I truly did.
I think there's also a hint there, and this is something I think I'm going to basically say, like, put a pin in this, because we'll find out more about Quark's backstory in the future. But I think that there's a hint there where she's talking about him selling food to the Bajorans, too.
I think this is like, yeah, there's like the under, we get this occasionally, but it's like, it's that undercurrent that Quark down somewhere is like, he does have a heart of gold. It's just like, it has to like, he does it begrudgingly, or he just refuses to be seen about it because he has to be so performatively Ferengi.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, at the same time, he doesn't seem to really be against the Ferengi-ish parts either.
Yeah.
But I guess that's the source of a lot of his problems, right?
Yeah. I think that's the thing with Quark, is that what makes him an interesting character is that he holds those two conflicting elements in tension. He is both a person who wants to, who cares for his friends and wants to do good things for them, and also is willing to fleece everything else to make a buck and succeed as a Ferengi. And his character very neatly holds those two things in tension, and they make some pretty good hay about when those two sides of him create difficult situations. I think it's what makes him such an interesting character.
And it caught attention here in this episode, because he's approaching this whole thing like a Ferengi. He's trying to buy her, essentially. Like, he's trying to bribe his way to, you know, keeping her on the station with him, instead of, you know, trying, you know, instead of a more give and take negotiation. Like, that he could have approached it being like, hey, you know what, Natima, like, DS9 would actually potentially be a really good base of operations for you and your students. Like, talk to Cisco, maybe like set up apartments here. Like, you know, it's a central hub that's pretty nearby. Like, you know, there would be a potential thread for that, but he's like laser focused on like students away, Natima here forever.
Yeah. He is altruistic in the most Ferengi way possible.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily a particularly altruistic way to other people. But you do see the genuine depth of his concern.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. Armin Shimerman really fucking goes to town on this episode, and he's so good in this episode. He's good in everything. I have yet to see a bad episode with him, but he really is working it this episode. And I have to imagine he had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I definitely
have come to think that DS9 is the best acted Star Trek show. And that includes modern ones. Because I was just like, I really have no reason to like Odo anymore, but I still do because Rene Auberjonois just nails it all the time.
Absolutely.
I think it's just like, I mean, even like in this episode, there's like, it's maybe 90 seconds, but the scene between Sisko and Garak is just, Andrew Robinson and Sisko Brooks are really fucking good actors. And just immediately, it's like the presence that both of them bring, and immediately just like, it's one of those things that is just like, these characters had like, had only been in passing once, but now, but immediately it is like, there is, they don't, I mean, part of this I think is the writing, where it's like, we don't have to remind, it's like, we're not reminding you of like, oh, remember when this happened or anything. It's immediately, they're just like sliding together and they know what each other is.
And
they're two titans. That's what they are. They're two titans. Like, they're, we're going to talk about like,
together.
Yeah. God. No, they're great. I would agree that certainly of all the of the older Treks, it's the best acted, and it beats the pants off what I saw of the couple of seasons I saw of Discovery. And I think it's interesting. It's a hard one, despite the fact that it, in terms of structure, it's actually quite similar to Strange New Worlds, in that it's trying to balance episodic with kind of threads of plot.
It's so hard to compare,
but they've
26 episode seasons to 10 episode seasons.
Yeah, like, exactly.
And every single facet, like, you know, and don't get me wrong, I love Strange New Worlds, but you know, it's really apples and oranges, because a lot of the stuff that we have at this point with how good the acting is at, even at this point in Deep Space Nine, a bit over halfway through season two, is that, at this point, everybody here basically has more episodes under their belt for this show than Strange New Worlds has at this point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they've done what?
Drastically
30 plus
more
episodes now of this show. And that's three seasons worth of Strange New Worlds. So,
yeah. And also just the length of it allows the writing to even out. Like, when there's a hiccup and someone acts out of character, that's one episode and there's five more where they are. Part of the reason Strange New Worlds started to annoy me, among other reasons, is that if there's an episode where someone's way out of character or the character writing takes a turn you don't like, it's like, well, that's like a fifth of the show right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. 10%
of the
season.
Just going to have to deal with that, I guess.
Yeah.
Can I? Okay. So I have two fantastic production notes from this episode.
Hit me.
Oh, yeah.
The first is that every time that Natima and Quark kissed, they would get their makeup on each other.
Yeah.
And so they had to touch up the makeup after every take of a kiss.
That's funny.
Which is
because she would end up orange and he would end up gray.
Yeah. Which I think is incredibly cute, of just like,
that's gonna be
annoying as fuck, but
yeah.
The other one is that this is the episode where the infamous earthquake happens. So during the filming, at about 4:30 in the morning, so casting call for this episode or like cast call was at 5 a.m. So people would get in, at like 3 a.m. to start having prosthetics and makeup done, because I mean, from what I've heard, like, doing an episode of Star Trek was like a 12-hour day, 16 if you were getting in makeup.
Jesus.
Like real makeup.
Yeah.
Like, Jadzia's spots were hand painted on every day for the shoot.
They have to be, I'll note that it has to be perfectly consistent every single time.
So at 4:31, when everybody's in makeup and like getting in prosthetics, I'm trying to find it. A 6.7 earthquake hit.
Oh,
which so for those of you who are not from California, we do not get out of bed for anything under a 4.5. because we are psychopaths who like people you, when you like have certain natural disasters, you just sort of become accustomed to. Earthquakes are like honestly the one that you can like, oh hey, that like rumbled me and I was in my car, whoop-de-doo. 6.7 is actually serious, and it's like it's not a linear scale, it's exponential. So
yeah,
6 point is pretty bad. And because of the earthquake, the phones went out. So a lot of the cast, in full makeup, drove home so they could make sure that their families were okay and everything because it was that early in the day. So you have like Armin Shimerman and Mary Crosby and like the guy who's playing the Cardassian. Like they're all in full makeup driving home.
That's really funny. I mean, not funny, terrifying, but also funny. Just the idea of Quark in like what I'm sure was like a neon Sentra, because they don't, you know, powering down the highway in L.A. trying to get home to check on his family.
Armin Shimerman notes that he's like, I definitely scared the crap out of my neighbors.
Oh, yeah. Plus a 6.7 earthquake and then an alien busts out of, you know, comes jogging down the street.
The phones aren't working. It's War of the Worlds happening.
That's funny.
It's incredible. And there's another fun production thing for this, which is that the original teleplay was apparently a like extremely close mirror to Casablanca. But the original title for this episode was "Here's Looking at You," apparently they changed all of the more obvious bit out of legal concerns.
That's funny.
which is interesting to me.
This will not be the first time they have to significantly rewrite episodes.
I'm one thing I am upset about with the name change is it's just profit and loss straight up. And I'm like, okay, but this should have been a Cisco episode called Profit and Loss. And they just leave that on the table. I'm like, damn it.
I find the episode title frustrates me because I always get it like it sounds so close to Profit and Lace,
which is another episode.
And I'm like, you can't have both of them. You have to pick one.
Also, this episode does confirm a very important thing that when they're embracing each other, confirms that the neck ridges are sensitive. And they 100% got up to some stuff with that. Just an important note for other kinds of writers.
Also a note. So I have questions, TM, regarding the Bajoran prisoner exchange thing. Because weren't all of the missing prisoners theoretically released in the Homecoming?
Theoretically.
Are the Cardassians, which is the lie? Did they lie about releasing prisoners, or did they lie about still having prisoners?
I am wondering if it's like all of the prisoners from the occupation got released, but, you know, the Cardassians have some more because the Bajorans keep doing, I'm going to, huge air quotes here, crimes to Cardassia.
Yeah. Good question.
Yeah. One of my favorite things is in the opening scene with Garak and Bashir, like he's questioning, am I an outcast? Am I a spy? What if you're an outcast spy? Who said I was either? What if I was both? And it's just like, it's the, like, the verbal, or maybe I'm an outcast spy. How could you be both? I never said I was either. It's just the, that is the epitome of their relationship. There will be a better quote that will come up in Checking Watch 4 episodes that will better personify their relationship, but right now that is the placeholder.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, and we also there's another fantastic catty bitch Garak quote that I love in this episode. After he vaporizes Taran, he says, "Well, some people should never be promoted."
God. Garrick is so good. Bitch. I love him.
I would really love to see him in full workplace gossip mode.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely. He definitely brought a water cooler energy to the horrific Central Intelligence Agency of Cardassia.
Also, there's a fun note, which is that Mary Crosby, who plays Natima, is not only Bing Crosby's daughter, but also Denise Crosby, a.k.a. Tasha Yar's aunt.
That's
despite
wild.
Despite being younger than Denise Crosby.
Yeah. Oh,
gross, Bing. Wild. I guess not gross. It doesn't have to be gross, but I just assume it's if just, he's famous, it's gross.
Yeah. Overall, like, I love this one. It's like, it's you know, maybe not the tightest plot, but I'm like, I love this. And like the stuff it sets up, and
it comes across as like a nothing burger in the moment, in that like there's no direct consequences. But you're right. The plot will get picked back up, and it is a very solid episode. It just needed like three more minutes of wrap up.
Other thing that I think is interesting, is this the first time that we see a Cardassian woman with a name?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just find that interesting. It's just like, oh yeah, right. Okay. Any last thoughts for this one?
Don't think so.
All right. Let's get to the good, but let's get to the great shit here.
Yeah, the meaty center of this episode. All right.
Arise, soldiers of the Empire. Ana, take us away from Blood Oath.
All right. This is episode 19 of season 2, written by Peter Allen Fields and directed by Winrich Kolbe. We open on Quark cajoling Odo after relocating an elderly and inebriated Klingon from a holosuite into the station drunk tank. Another Klingon named Koloth shows up in security but finds the old man still drunk and leaves him in holding. When Odo complains to Jadzia about his Klingon afternoon with all this, she recognizes the elderly Klingon as Curzon's old friend Kor. She bails him out, introduces herself, and is joyfully embraced as Kor's beloved old friend Jadzia in what may be, like, certainly like a top 10 DS9 moment. The two find Koloth in the Replimat, and Dax once again introduces herself, although Koloth is less enthusiastic about the change from Curzon to Jadzia. They're joined by the Klingon who organized this reunion, Kang, who announces that he has finally found someone named the Albino. Backstory on this, eight decades ago, the Albino was a raider targeting Klingon colonies. His base was destroyed by the three Klingon captains, Kor, Kang, and Koloth, but he escaped and killed the captain's firstborn sons, one of whom was Dax's godson, as revenge. Kor, Kang, Koloth, and Curzon all swore a blood oath to track down and kill him. Kang formally releases Jadzia from Curzon's oath, arguing that Joined Trill are not bound by their past host's obligations, but she does not want to be released. Distressed by both the end goal of the oath, murdering the Albino, and by being released from it itself, Jadzia explains the situation to Kira, who urges her not to join the Klingons on their quest for vengeance. But Dax feels that she owes it to Curzon to follow through, even if the Klingons do not expect her aid. Thinking that Kang and Koloth must view her as too weak to join them in battle, Dax challenges Koloth to a Betleth duel in the holosuites. He concedes that she is a highly skilled warrior, and her presence would honor their mission, and Kang finally agrees to her participation as well, as he doesn't have the right to deny her vengeance for Curzon's godson. Sisko, however, refuses to grant her a leave of absence. He cannot condone murder, did not understand Curzon's dedication to the oath, and is baffled that Jadzia feels the need to honor it. Jadzia calls his bluff. She intends to follow the Klingons, and any consequences are up to Sisko to determine. And she will be back later. Probably. Maybe. We'll see. As Dax and the Klingons discuss strategy, it's revealed that things aren't quite what they initially seemed. Kang's initial plan is a suicide mission, prompted by the Albino's offer to him of a final glorious battle against 40 of his very best warriors. Dax insists that instead of just, like, dying in a suicide mission against, you know, in a glorious battle against 40 of the best warriors, that they actually, like, try to succeed instead. and shows the benefit of having Jadzia on their side rather than Curzon, because she is tech-savvy and will be able to disable the guards' phasers from orbit, leaving the Klingons with the advantage in close-quarters combat. Upon arrival, Dax also realizes that the albino never meant to keep up his end of the bargain at all. He just meant to vaporize them all with a mine at the entrance. They work out an alternate plan and set it in motion. Koloth is killed in the approach, and Kang is mortally wounded by the albino in their battle, but Dax catches the albino unawares and introduces herself at Batleth Point. She hesitates in killing him, and he mocks her lack of resolve, but Kang manages to stab him before collapsing, thanking Dax for letting him have the death blow, and dying himself. Kor, as the only Klingon remaining, sings in honor of his fallen friends. Dax returns to the station to side eyes, but no comment from both Kira and Sisko.
A lot of emotions here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is a messy episode.
Yeah. It is. So I was given homework for this episode.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was told to watch the TOS episodes. What was the first one? The one on Arganea.
Errand of Mercy.
Errand of Mercy, Trouble with Tribbles, and Day of the Doves.
Yep.
In preparation for this episode, so I would know who Kor, Koloth, and Kang were.
Yeah, because as a note, all three of them were on the original series, and they are played by the same actors, and it is fucking incredible.
Now, before we go into any of this episode, that begs the question. In the TOS episodes, they are mustachioed Orientalist caricatures. And in this episode,
they're forehead ridged Orientalist caricatures.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
The
first answer is they decided that yellowface probably wasn't a good thing to have as like your one of your things in 90s television.
Yes, I understand the Watsonian, or what is it, the Doylist explanation for this, but I'm curious what the justification in universe is.
You're gonna hate this. I'm gonna give you
not just because it's apparently done on Enterprise, so insultingly pointed out to me by Anna.
So I'm going to give you the actual answer in canon, and I'm going to give you a fan answer that I think is a lot better and very coolly thought out that I enjoy and like is part of my personal trek canon. So, hold on, I have to figure out how. So in 2154, before the Federation even happens, a bunch of augments, like genetic super soldiers from the 20th century, escape and steal a Klingon bird of prey and like wreak havoc before they are eventually brought to justice, involving a cameo from Brent Spiner. Now, these super soldiers, these augments, catch the attention of the Klingons. They said, and a scientist says, what if we make Klingon super soldiers? He jabs some Klingons full of, you know, green liquid. I did not rewatch these episodes. Nobody correct me. I'll fucking kill you.
Yeah, this is like a two-parter, right?
This is a three-parter. I did.
Oh, Jesus.
It definitely dragged.
So it does like create these super soldier Klingons that are like tougher, faster, stronger, smarter. But it does make them more human, and their forehead ridges retract so they become smooth. But one of the test subjects has COVID. And it merges with COVID to create like a super virus, which spreads across many planets across the Klingon Empire. And I swear to God, I am not making this up.
No, dude, this is the actual answer.
they are able to.
I told you you'd hate it.
They are able to cure.
For our listeners, Jude is sitting completely still.
This is like,
this just like,
I hate this.
So, like,
I knew I would hate it when you told me Enterprise is where this answer came from. But this is legitimately worse. I was ready for it to be some weird genetics mumbo jumbo, but this is worse than I expected.
Like, so it's weird up until the augments thing, and then it goes way off the rails.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely, it's batshit. So yeah, they eventually cure the super COVID. And like, but they're like, yeah, no, some like, and so like the people who are affected by this, like they're able to cure it. So they don't get the super soldier genes, but their foreheads still are smooth. And they're like, yeah. And they basically hand wave it and say like, yeah, it's a recessive gene apparently that does this. So eventually it'll like get bred out and like, maybe it can be even cured with therapy, like a century or two down the road. Wink, wink.
So how do they explain Kor and Koloth and Kang?
So the idea is that they were Klingons who were affected by this virus, but eventually received gene therapy to cure them of it.
Or possibly plastic surgery.
They told the actors that this is just the natural Klingon aging process.
Yeah, because this was all before Enterprise, obviously.
So, oh my god.
Personally,
my favorite is Worf's answer to it, which is, "We do not discuss it."
That was a way funnier answer, honestly.
That's very good.
So there is a fan answer to this, however, that I personally really like. It is a Trek. I'm getting the name just so that way I can like actually like credit the person on air properly.
I think you might have told me about this in the past.
I can't find the name of him right now. I'm so sorry to this person. But basically the idea is that the Klingons evolved with many sentient races with common genetic ancestry on one planet. And that the traditional Klingons that like with the ridge forehead are called the Hemkush, the proud forehead. And that the smooth headed Klingons are called the Kusha, the unhappy ones. And like that they are two related but distinct species. But like the document that I have is, it is assumed in the Federation they were created by the augment virus, but this is not so. The pathogen de-evolved Hemkush subjects into their genetic cousins, a grave embarrassment for any Hemkush. Basically the idea being that it's like that each of the times you see the Klingons with different foreheads, it's a different subspecies that all evolved in Kronos. Because the Discovery ones also look different.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense. That makes way more sense to have it just be as if on Earth, Cro-Magnons and Homo sapiens and some other human variant all survived into the modern age and looked different, but
And that is personally like my headcanon that is like, when I am writing fan fiction, like I sort of like attribute that because it's like it solves a lot of problems internally that I think.
Yeah.
And then the different eras are just different times when different groups are politically dominant. That's why they're.
Yeah.
Personally, I'm just in the camp of there was no need to explain it to begin with because it's not like.
Yeah,
it's not like them having flat foreheads in the original series affected the plot at all.
Right.
If there was an episode plot that no longer makes sense with a design change across any of these shows, then it probably behooves you to explain it. But I was just sort of like,
if that had been the answer, I would have been fine with that.
It's just cues to the audience that this is a Klingon.
If the answer had been that. There was no answer that was what the makeup looked like before. This is what it looks like now. Don't worry about it. I would have been fine with that.
Yeah.
Enterprise's answer is absolute. It's fucking so dumb. Garbage.
I truly like the
those are three of you know how we talk about how Enterprise is good if you exclude like half a dozen episodes. This is half of the half a dozen.
The story about how this episode came to be was that it was originally a story called The Beast and didn't feature the original Klingons, but they decided to just check to see if they were available. And they eventually found everybody. And, like, one of them, it took a while to find because he was just doing Star Trek cruises.
That's like fan amazing. Cruises.
Incredible. I love the tradition of Trek actors being huge Trekkies, by the way.
And oh, he was a guest. That's what it, like, that's, oh, what, yeah. That's what mm-hmm. it was. But they eventually, like, get them all back. And God, what's the there's a really funny quote where William Campbell, who plays Koloth, he's looking at the other Klingons as he's in the prosthetics, and he's like, "This is so hot." And he's like, and he says, like, "James, Jim, I haven't worked in 6 years. This is gonna kill me."
So, with regards to the Klingons, those three episodes are absolutely buck wild. Mm-hmm. I loved those episodes. They were so weird. I had some thoughts watching those episodes. The one I loved the most was Kang, just because he has. The actor who plays Kang has such an incredible... Michael Ansara has such an incredible voice.
I know.
The second he spoke in the TOS episode, I was like, freeze gun, freeze gun. Who's got a freeze gun? Because I immediately recognized him as Mr. Freeze from Batman the Animated Series. And I get... I am of the age... where that show, if you were a voice actor on that show, that is all you will ever be to me. Those voices are seared into my heart. So, and I'm not even like a DC person.
I mean, there's worse things to be forever than a universally beloved children's show villain.
Well, and he is so incredibly good on that show.
Yeah. Mr. Freeze is I would say, like, it's the most, he's the most three-dimensional like villain on that show, to the point where I would hesitate to even call him a villain.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
The episode where he's introduced is possibly my favorite episode of the entire run. Yeah.
And that is 40%, like, you know, that is half of it is Michael Ansara as Atlas carrying that episode on his shoulders.
Well, yeah, he just has incredible gravitas in his voice. And so when he starts to talk in the TOS episode, my jaw hit the floor. And when he comes back in this one, it was so gratifying to hear his voice again and just be like, yeah, he still got it.
And I'll note that and remind everybody that this is not the first time we've had Michael Ansara on Bad Pod, because
he was Technomage.
Played Elric the Technomage with another notable, incredible speech.
Yeah. I got to do a little bit of homework on these episodes. My only real note that I'm not going to try and go through my notes from those three episodes, but I will say I thought it was interesting that Kor, who is this like hard-edged, bloodthirsty, like fascist dictator in his episode, is now a drunken buffoon in this episode. Yeah. The other ones seem more or less consistent.
Part of it is, I think that, like, there is a little bit of, like, the what the Klingons are is, like, they change in the century and change between the original series and when this happened, of, like, they're no longer, like, the authoritarian dictatorship. They're now... I mean, for better or worse, they're space samurai Vikings.
Yeah. And Klingons are very long lived, and you know, Kor would have been very young in that Star Trek episode. You know, that was like, you know, that may have been like his first command, etc.
Yeah. No, I don't have a problem with the change. I thought it was just interesting that the other two seemed a little more like not as much changed, but Kor. And they kind of address it too. There's that great scene in the bar in Quarks where he's talking to Jadzia, and he's like lamenting the fact that he's fatter and slower than he was when 80 years ago. And I'm sitting here going, yeah, man, doesn't take 80 years.
The actual line is, I was once, as you remember, far less than you can see and far more than I've become. I'm sorry. Which, you know what? I mean, like, between James Colicos and Michael Ansara, William Campbell, they do not fucking make actors like this anymore. Just built different.
Yeah.
There's... I mean, part of that is just how actors are trained now, but like
the
Shakespearean like presence that all three of them are just like, they're bringing, like, it is their Shakespeare A game in this, and I love it so much.
Yeah. As far as the episode, man, what a good episode.
Yeah.
I was prepared for this to be like a good Dax episode, because I knew I knew we were bringing Velvet on, so I knew it was a Dax episode. But the moment in the jail cell, you know, Curzon, my old friend, it's Jadzia now. Jadzia, my old friend. It's just like, man, fuck yeah, Klingons say trans rights. That's pretty dope. He's like, doesn't miss a beat, except that he's like, can I fuck you now? Like,
fantastic. You're hot now. Let's kiss.
Yeah, it's the perfect old man energy on top of just immediate acceptance. Like,
I forgot about that part when I went back to watch this episode. They sell that as pretty charming, and obviously that's a really good feel-good moment. Star Trek does have those moments where you just feel like the happiest, calmest, safest little thing. But also it's like...
gross.
They're like weirdly... they're being weird about it, but in a way that they know they're being weird about it, but not in the way they think it's weird.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It rolls as a really good moment. Like, his grossness, though, it's like one line, and for the rest of the episode he is like, that's Curzon, that's Dax, it's Jadzia now. And when I think it's particularly funny that when he takes Jadzia to meet Koloth, he's like, you don't recognize our old friend Curzon? Like, he's like completely like gaslighting this guy, like as if he recognized her immediately.
Yes. Yeah, and I love how Kor, like, to the other two is just like, guys, it's Dax. Like, it's our bestie. Like look, you know. Mm-hmm. He's, like, just singing Jadzia's praises and, like, trying to get the other two to accept her. And I love Kor.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I think it's Kang is being resistant about the idea because he doesn't want her to come.
Yeah.
Not that he's not accepting of the concept. He's doing the thing where alienating a friend so they don't get in danger.
And especially when we realize that, no, actually Kang knows a lot about the Trill, because he's there being like, well, you know, Curzon and I talked about this sort of thing, and like, I know that you all aren't held to oaths from your previous lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, like, he clearly does understand. He's just being a jerk because he doesn't want Dax to die.
Yeah, his rejection of Dax is not because it's a new Dax. It's because it's Dax, and he doesn't want Dax to die for this. And that's a convenient, it's a way for him to give Dax an out so that Dax doesn't have to die in this.
God, which I think is very... make this drama messy in a fun way.
I love though that also they are like, you know, how are you even going to help? You're, you know, a diplomat, you know, because their idea of what Curzon was a, you know, a nerdy diplomat, a dirty, horny diplomat.
Not a nerd. I mean, I think
well, but they have this idea of Curzon as being one thing, and then, but Jadzia is different. And Jadzia is like a, you know, scientist battle maiden. Which I think is fantastic, because she's just like, okay, fuck you guys. Give me a Batleth, I'll kick your ass.
And I love the moment where she's like, well, if I were Curzon, you'd all be fucked, but I'm Jadzia now. So, like, yeah. I can help you with this.
Yeah. God, Jadzia's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is also an interesting moment for her, too, because one thing I noticed in the previous episode and this one is the Force is antagonistic to her. People keep trying to insist that she isn't Curzon. And other forces trying to insist she is. And like, even in the original episode, they would comfort her that way. That's the premise Sisko's operating on. And she stays silent through the whole thing to protect something Curzon did. And here, like, Kira tries to comfort her, like, you're not Curzon. You don't have to hold to the oath. But she never feels comforted by this notion. She won't accept that. Any assertion that she is Curzon, but like, I keep getting the sense from just like how she's acted and how she kind of bears it silently that like people keep trying to draw firm lines on the topic and she doesn't do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like she's choosing what she wants to continue and what she doesn't. Cause
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Being Absolutely. Trill muddies the lines, but everyone else wants to be like, clean break. Jadzia, Curzon, or same thing all the way through.
People,
yeah.
It's like people want a yes or no. They want a binary answer where one doesn't apply.
Yeah, almost, right?
Yeah. Especially this, and this episode's a great example of that because Jadzia feels a personal connection to this blood oath, but for her own reasons, not because she's Curzon, but because she feels she owes it to Curzon. And also she has an emotional connection to those memories for having been there for Dax. Like, yeah. I love the, it's messy and nuanced. And I think it's really a really interesting portrayal of how Trill, the way that the serial lives of the Trill plays out. I think it's also really interesting that Curzon's history with the Klingon, the way that that has influenced Jadzia, because mm-hmm. clearly, and I do know a little bit that Jadzia is like into Klingon stuff. I have a vague memory of her slurping down a bowl full of bloodworms in a future episode. My recollection is that Jadzia is a little bit of a Klingon weeb, was kind of my thought process before this.
Mm.
But I didn't know when I had that thought, I didn't know Curzon had this history. And that makes a lot more sense that she has this deep personal connection with the Klingons. I didn't know that Curzon fucking like was like integral to the establishment of peace with the Klingons between the Federation and the Klingons. I didn't know that.
Incredible Sarek backstory. Mentioned.
Listing great diplomats. Sarek mentioned.
The something that I really enjoy is we also like learn a little bit of like what Curzon did is like he was, and this is something that I find really interesting of like that he was the, and that might be because he was a Trill and the Trill weren't like at the time weren't members of the Federation.
I don't think they're members of the Federation at this point either.
They're not. I remember reading an article that they didn't. The first time they joined the Federation is in the Discovery Future era.
Okay. But that Curzon is the first people to like approach the Klingons on their terms. You know, he's the first person to like go. He's the first diplomat to go there. And he's like, I'm not just here to negotiate with you. I am here to understand this and, you know, create a dialogue to the point where, you know, he is literally godfather to one of their children who is named Dax.
Yeah.
That's broke wild. My heart a little bit.
Oh my god.
Yeah. And this is where like Sisko, I understand that Sisko, you know, being a human raised in the Federation does not understand this. But like on the other hand, he's like, I never understood why Curzon like signed on for this. And it's like, Sisko, like, this was Curzon's godson.
Yeah.
Who was named after him. Like,
yeah.
Like, how do you not understand that this is a huge deal?
Mm-hmm. I think that Sisko before Wolf 359 probably does not deeply understand revenge as a human growing up in the Federation.
Yeah.
I think that probably is not a concept that the Federation fosters particularly deeply outside of like fiction. And even after, and we see in the way that he interacts with like Picard afterwards, even with Picard, who he personally holds responsible, he has trouble holding on to that like personal vendetta against Picard. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't get me wrong, I loved seeing him be like a frosty bitch to Picard, but like even by the end of that episode, he was thawing a little bit. Like, it's just not in his nature, and maybe he'll get there. I don't know what's in the future for fucking Sisko, but from what we've seen so far, he just isn't someone who like gets revenge.
Yeah.
Right now. Certainly, I would imagine, should he go through like a war, he would get it. Because we see O'Brien. O'Brien gets it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think on those attitudes towards death and revenge and stuff, like the line that Jadzia has that chastising Kang for treating death like a lover.
What a line.
Yeah, that's a big line. And also illustrative of her difference from Curzon, because earlier in the episode they say Curzon died in hospital and was like getting mad at all the doctors and nurses, like, don't waste your time, this is my time, just let me go out, right?
And when we like, learn the circumstances of Curzon's death, it becomes even funnier.
Yeah, so like we've got this angry old man who was totally down for a blood oath of revenge and like ready to accept death about it. But as Jadzia says, she finds life much more attractive. I don't know. I just felt that was a really important line in how people treat death, because we like see that a little bit in other characters too.
Yeah.
Like, like Sisko doesn't see it that way, but he definitely sees it a little bit differently than Dax. And then, of course, Kira's there, who instantly recognizes the look in someone's eyes when they're about to do a murder.
I love the scene where Kira is like trying to talk down Jadzia.
Yeah,
that whole interaction is,
and using all the wrong arguments.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, I love that Jadzia goes to Kira. And I love that she does it so fucking awkwardly and like badly.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I love their conversation. Everything about it is so, leans in so hard into the developing close friendship between, or close relationship, depending on how hard you ship these two, between Kira and Jadzia, because that's a fucking wild question to ask somebody, particularly a resistance fighter with pretty intense PTSD. And Kira gets it. Like, she doesn't want to talk about it and she's mildly offended, but she gets that Jadzia is not doing it for like titillation.
Yeah.
And engages, like tries to talk to Jadzia about it. But as you say, she does not understand what's happening, the circumstances. And I like that they talk it out. It doesn't become some like misunderstanding spat the way that a lot of TV shows do that. Mm-hmm. They talk about it and they come to a better understanding of each other through it.
Yeah. That Kira, like at first it's like, where the fuck did that come? And then come from, and then it's like, wait, where the fuck did that come from? Buddy, are you okay?
Yeah, the line, what is it? She says, are you thinking about killing somebody? And she says it like a joke. And then Dax, like, she's like, Dax, where is your poker face? You could bluff a table full of Ferengi, but you can't, like, keep it together for 1 second.
I mean, she's not used to this sort of thing. Curzon yeah. saw his fair share of stuff, but she's a lot younger and a lot more Federation oriented, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't get the sense that any of Dax's hosts were particularly warriors. Maybe I'm wrong.
There is, out of all of them, they're all like either scientists or politicians.
Or there's a gymnast in there too.
Oh yeah, there is one. There is a gymnast
and a pilot.
The pilot put under scientist because he was a fucking nerd.
That's accurate. Yes.
Yeah.
And then there's that other one that we'll talk about later.
Oh yeah. No. Are there Trill warriors? Fuck.
Jude, put a pin in this. Put a pin in this conversation.
We'll come back to it at the start of next
season.
Oopsies.
Are there Trill warriors in general, though?
Oh, I'm thinking about this now. Oh, no. Oh, no.
Do you guys need a headphones moment?
Maybe.
Yeah, you know, Jude, just take it off. Okay. I forgot about Jiraiya.
We know that Jadzia is closer to, what's his face, right? Jadzia is, like, in some ways more integrated with Dran, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is during the period where all those memories are repressed. So I imagine.
But it's, like, during the period where they were, like, they would have been, considering the timing, they would have been, like, potentially, like, we're pretty close. We're pretty close to the Duran episode, whatever the fuck Duran is. Duran, yeah. We're pretty close to that. Yeah.
Remind me, is Duran the murderer?
Yeah.
One?
Yes.
The serial
okay.
killer.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know how to feel about that episode. I don't like it. But
I think that's like at the start of season three. Do you want to skip that one?
I mean, were you planning on having me on for that one?
I mean,
I'll
I
be
was
on
gonna
for
ask
it.
You.
Yeah, no, I'll be on for it. Just okay. I might be somewhat negative on the idea.
I think it's fair. I think it's a rough one.
I would agree that it's not necessarily a good episode. The existence of Duran puts this into a slightly different context, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think because his memories are repressed, I don't think it actually like affects it. I think it's an interesting thing to think about once we get mm-hmm. to that. But I think it doesn't like take away anything from like Jadzia's actual emotional stakes in this episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which Jude, headphones, you good? I do think just like talking about Jadzia's emotional thing. Apparently Terry Farrell had campaigned for the episode to end with Jadzia holding the albino's heart.
Really?
Like she had apparently wanted to like have the episode end on it, like with her holding the heart in its hand and like leave it on a cliffhanger of like, does she eat it or not? Which I'm like, Terry Farrell, the woman that you are. Fuck yes.
That would have been.
I love Terry Farrell.
That would have been an amazing end to the episode. Holy shit!
Yeah, that's what you do if you're not a coward.
I'm kind of glad they didn't. I feel like it fucks with the messaging somewhat. But
oh yeah.
That said, I do want that for Jadzia. I do want her to be able to satisfy some bloodlust.
Yeah.
And I don't just say that because
I'm a lesbian. It'd just be a fantastic, like, open-ended question of, like, did she eat the heart? Did she not eat the heart? Who the fuck knows?
Yeah.
It's not on screen.
It's just, like, the image of that alone is, like, very compelling. It's, like, I like how they end the episode, but that would have been a badass way to...
Yeah, how do you all feel about the ending of, like, Kira and Sisko looking at her knowingly, but... not saying anything and just letting it go.
It's a weird, somber ass ending.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's fitting for those characters because of reasons. I won't do another headphones moment, but it left me feeling not sure how to feel about it because, like, they treated the moment before like it was triumphant but tragic because
like Kang died and Koloth died and stuff.
Yeah.
But
it's, I think that in a more modern episode, like a more modern method of storytelling, this would have been a scene in a future episode where, I mean, DS9 doesn't have a counselor. So, I mean, there would be a conversation in like Quarks or something about what happened, but, I mean, I think it does leave it a little bit. I think it maybe leaves it a little bit too much to the imagination.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely read the final blow this way, that Jadzia was genuinely hesitating to kill the young albino. Mm-hmm. Kang gets the kill and then is like, I thank you for honoring me this last time and giving me the killing blow. And like, whether he read that she wasn't going to go through with it and this is his way of acknowledging that, or if he didn't know, or if Jadzia was just genuinely waiting to give him the killing blow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the ambiguity. Like, I read it as that she was genuinely hesitating, but there is ambiguity there. And I really like Kang's, like, thanking her for saving the final blow, because it's like it saves face potentially, but also like it's a nice like positive note to end that on.
Whatever the reason was that she was waiting, Kang makes it the right choice.
Yeah.
Whether she was waiting because she was uncertain or whatever it was, Kang's words make it the right choice and give her the peace to know that was the right decision to make, to wait so that he could have that final blow, which I really like.
It's like she ultimately gives him the gift of letting him have the blow, and he gives her the gift of taking the final blow, basically.
Yeah.
And it's thanking her for it.
Yeah. I like, this is a great episode, and I think that ending is, I don't know that I would have had that ending with her walking onto the bridge and just the silent acknowledgement. But I like it. I think if they hadn't done it, I would have vented about the fact that there was no resolution again to this like wild thing that happens and there's no like follow through or consequences. But I like that we get that moment where you see, you know, Sisko silently accepting her return with qualms.
And she knows Sisko and she calls his bluff there, because he's like, you're not allowed to go. Like, you won't be allowed back if you go do a murder. Like, things won't be the same. And she's like, just like, want to bet?
Yeah.
And then just leaves.
Yeah.
And like, she called his bluff correctly, right? Yeah. Like, for better or for worse.
A couple more lighthearted notes. I really like the part where she's trying to get Kang mad to get him on her side. And he's like, you really think that trick will work twice? Well, it will. Let's go.
And there's like the thing is like, he's like, and if my hand should slip while we fight, it's like, and her response is, your hand would never slip unless you're old and feeble. it's just like, goddamn, that is a thing Curzon Dax said.
Yeah, I love that. I genuinely like that Jadzia knows how to like be a Klingon. She knows how to like insult like a Klingon. And I think that's very funny. It's a side of her we haven't really seen this far, but it makes a lot of sense given Curzon's backstory, and I like it.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, Koloth, I think it was Koloth. Koloth used to be called Iceman.
Yes. Yes.
You can be my wingman anytime, Curzon. No, Koloth. You can be mine.
I want to see. Give me Koloth in an F-15.
I was going to say, there has to be fan art of these guys playing beach volleyball because of that line.
Oh, gosh.
Hanging out with the boys.
Hanging out with the Klingons. or so, what are they called? The something masters?
Dahar Masters.
The Dahar Masters. I'm assuming Dahar Master is like a sword master or something because they're
Batleft. I think it's an honorary rank, I think.
It sounds like black belt or something.
That reminds me of another question I had. The albino. Is that a thing in Klingon society that albinos are like verboten? Because we have the albino in this and then the albino in Discovery.
Okay, the albino it's not clear whether he's Klingon.
I choose to believe that he's a Klingon. He's one of the Discovery Klingons. That's my head.
Yeah. Yeah, that's also mine. Like, yeah,
I think it's cooler if it is.
Also, I fucking love that we're here 81 years in the future and they have not learned this fucker's name.
I find that very funny, just because, or he's like, he has a nom de guerre.
Yeah.
Well, he has a name, but they're like, they won't deign to use it. They're just, that pale motherfucker.
Yes. I also love we get a bit of fantastic Quark and Odo banter in this.
Oh yeah. The thing where it's like, he'll kill you. No, he'll kill you. Yes. Which in that scene, if you listen closely, the sound that the door makes when the hollow suite opens is the original series door noise.
Incredible. Oh, yay.
That's wow. Dope.
Which I was just like, wait, I know that. Wait, fuck.
Other question.
And I love Odo in like the way that he de-escalates that situation too.
Yeah. Is the battle, they mentioned that battle a bunch. The Kel Bracht.
Which is the Klingon name for the Briar Patch, which is a hostile, very difficult to navigate part of space that is the setting for Star Trek Insurrection.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Huh. Is there like a noteworthy battle there in the past, or did they make it up for this episode?
They made it up for this, but basically it's where the Klingons and Romulans butted heads.
Hmm.
And apparently there was hand-to-hand combat because the nebula made everything so fucked.
Okay, that makes sense. As much as anything in Star Trek does.
Yeah. I choose to believe that the Klingons will use any excuse for boarding actions and hand-to-hand combat. Yeah.
That is the smallest logical leap I've ever heard.
Yeah, I mean, I choose to
bringing down an enemy's shields is not so you can blow them up with lasers. It's so you can transport over and beat them up.
Yeah. The whole reason they have cloaking devices is so they can get close enough to board, not so they can do a sneak attack.
Yeah.
So some production notes for this that I found very fun. Apparently, like when it was announced that the three original Klingons would be returning, it was like a huge fan thing. Michael Okuda, who I don't think we've actually talked about on the show, but like Michael Okuda is more responsible for the way Star Trek looks than possibly any other human being on this planet.
Yes.
He's basically the set designer for all of Star Trek.
I mean, he's the like the visual language designer for Star Trek. It's not just the sets. It's the, what do the computers look like? What is the visual language that Star Trek communicates with?
But he specifically said, like, you know, you couldn't, like, at first you didn't recognize them because they were in heavy Klingon makeup. But as soon as Michael Ansar opened his mouth, there was a powerful sense of deja vu. It was magical for everyone.
That's awesome.
It was magical for us too.
I'm like, I do find it like really cute that it's just like everybody was like really into it. Apparently, all three Klingon actors William Campbell said that it was the most difficult acting job he ever had, but he would do it again in a heartbeat.
That's awesome.
I'm just like, apparently, like they all loved it and they had a lot of fun with it. John Colicos.
And this isn't the last time we see Kor either.
No, it will not. Kor will return.
That's like, good that, to know.
Better than any Avengers cliffhanger. Core will return. he didn't know he wanted to take the role originally, but they were like, hey, we have this role for you. We want you to play Core as sort of a Falstaff hero. A sort of buffoonish at first, but complicated hero. And he was like, he was on the fence with it, and he's like, I want to read the full script first because I want to know how it ends before I take the role. And he did, and he saw the end, and he's like, no, this iteration of Core surviving to the end is the best dramatic choice. Fuck yeah, I'm on for this.
Nice.
Which I'm like, that's cool. The albino's compound is actually a real house.
I recognized it immediately.
Yeah, it is actually a Frank Lloyd Wright design. And on set, while they were like between takes when they were filming the battle scenes, Winrich Colby had them play Wagner on the set to get them in the mood. Which I'm like, that's a badass move there as a director.
That's fucking fantastic. Yeah.
Which, speaking of music, the music of this episode rips.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, I'll also say that in my notes I say Dax quoting Hamilton at the Klingons, but in fact the first time I listened to the Hamilton soundtrack and heard the line "Dying is easy, young man, living is harder," I basically like was like, ah. Jadzia's speech to Kang.
That's
because
funny.
I can absolutely imagine like Jadzia or Curzon saying that, especially Jadzia saying that to the Klingon who she is both younger than and substantially older than.
Yeah.
Another like thing of like perception. Robert O'Reilly, who plays Gowron, who we have not seen on the show yet. But already been there. Apparently, like, loved the episode. He was apparently a huge Klingon nerd, and he was like nice. So excited for this. And I'm like, oh, that's. I really like. I mean, this is one of those episodes where it's like, you hear the premise and it's the three original, like the three big original Klingons come back over to do Seven Samurai. And you're like, this could go wrong in so many ways, but no. I mean, honestly, I think Seven Samurai, Magnificent Seven is just the easiest. It's the easiest plot to get right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, let's not talk about the most recent adaptation of it.
I was just gonna say, and yet, if you're Zack Snyder,
oh, that was a Zack Snyder movie.
Rebel Moon?
Oh, that explains everything.
That explains a lot.
Did you watch that yet, Velvet?
Yeah, I did. I'm actually kind of a closet Western nerd. So whenever there's a big Western release, I'm there for it. And
no wonder
it pissed
you're
me
trekkie.
Off, especially.
Yeah. The big spider lady.
I would say no wonder you're a Trekkie, because we've talked a few times about how
Wagon Train to the Stars.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Like, obviously I have some complicated feelings about it.
Hold on, let me look at my Deadlands
because
collection on the
even
shelves.
When I was learning in school, like, I was aware of all the issues with the Western genre.
Yeah.
And I don't like a lot of American Western movies, but I'm getting off track. Point is.
Velvet, do you wish for people to find you on the internet?
I do. I'm at Velvet the Dragon on Twitter and Blue Sky. And you can look up the Clever Corvids Productions Podcast Network at clevercorvids.net or find us on Twitter. Listen to City That Never Dies.
You can also find Velvet on the forthcoming Athroplay podcast.
Right. That'll happen at some point.
It's very soon. By the time this is out, it may even be out already.
So next time, we are going to be doing a two-parter, babes. We are doing episodes 20 and 21 of season 2, The Maquis. Until next time, just keep circling. keep circling. Just keep circling.
Just keep circling.
Yeah.
Just keep circling.
Just keep circling. Just keep circling. Just keep circling. Just keep circling.
The Babylon Project is an independent production. All views expressed on the show are our own. Clips from the original show remain property of the original owner. Music information can be found in the show notes. The rest of the show is licensed under a Creative Commons 4.0 share-alike no derivatives license.